It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a new prototype for vibrating insoles could help improve balance for senior citizens. We'll learn about how this technology works and get some other cool science news with Gemma Tarlak of Discover Magazine.
First, a dispute between the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation and Democratic lawmakers serving on its board is in public view now. The dispute is based on open records requests from the Democratic board members, and it's been going on for nearly a year. The Wisconsin Department of Justice's Office of Open Government was asked now to step in to help.
Matthew DeFore is covering that story, and he's with us now. He's the state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Matt, welcome back to Central Time.
Veronica, always a pleasure.
Well, this has been a dispute that's been going on for a while. Give us a little bit of the backstory here. How did this all get started?
Well, about a year ago, we had a story out about the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation providing a $500,000 loan to a company named Building Committee, Inc. back in 2011. And one of the findings that we came across was that the WEDC could not provide what's known as a staff review or a written document explaining, you know, the positives and negatives about that particular application. They didn't have one on file for BCI. And so that caused a lot of stir back in May of last year. The Democratic lawmakers on the board, Cedar Barca and Julie Lassa, they called for an investigation. And about a month later, WEDC came out with a finding that there were 27 other awards between 2011 and 2013 that also did not have a staff review that they could identify. And so there were, I think, $120-some-odd million of awards that fell in under those 28 awards. And that, you know, caused a lot of concern. Since then, there's been back and forth between Barca and Representative Barca and Senator Lassa's office and the WEDC about providing more information about those awards and some of the internal email communications about them to help perhaps the public find out more about why these awards were given without a staff review and maybe even why they can't find those reviews.
And it sounds as though we are not anywhere near the completion of these documents being handed over. What does WEDC say about why it's taken a while to hand those over?
Well, a lot's been happening since that first report came out. For one thing, the agency has a new CEO, Mark Hogan, who replaced Reed Hall sometime in the fall. Prior to Mark starting, there was a little bit of pushback from the WEDC. They had put out an estimate that there would be more than 450,000 records. I think it was more than 462,000 records. That's not even pages. That's just records that they had identified that related to these 28 awards. And so I think the Democrats at the time saw that as sort of an attempt to you know, make them lose interest in pursuing these records because they were so voluminous. But, you know, there's been a lot of back and forth. But since then, they've sort of started the process of trying to turn over the records. And when they provided the first award back in February, I think it was, or January, February, it was just for one award, and it was some 20,000 pages of documents. And when the Democrats finally got that, they said, well, you're giving us all these documents, all these pages of records and newsletters and calendars and things that we didn't request. They pointed out that Building Committee Inc., when that came out back in June, there were about 800 pages of emails. And so they're basically their beef with the agency is that this, even in its first award, they were sort of almost providing a volume of records that it was difficult to really figure out anything. And they, again, continued to see that as a form of sort of trying to discourage them from getting to the bottom of basically what they're going after.
Well, do we know if there is something that exists that is a single document running through the review of the application for that grant? Does such a thing exist, or is it necessary to provide them all of this documentation?
Well, the issue here is not the staff review. They've already acknowledged that they cannot find the a staff review for, it turns out, 27 of these 28 awards. In fact, doing this review, they found one of the staff reviews that they were not able to find last year. But the issue here is more about what the communication was inside the agency. If you remember, in the case of BCI last year, these email conversations revealed that the company had, at one point, there was a phone call from a car leasing dealership that where the car leasing dealership called up WEDC and said, hey, we were promised that we were going to get paid back for this guy's, the owner of BCI. He had leased some luxury vehicles. He was going to pay us back with money from WEDC. Where's our money? And the agency had some email conversations about that. So, again, that came out only because they turned over the records related to BCI. And so I think part of the interest in getting more emails is to find out, at least according to Representative Barca, he's saying we may see further evidence of other malfeasance if we were to dig through all these records. Of course, the agency is saying, you know, we dealt with these issues. We've already made sure that these staff reviews are happening, that there's not going to be a repeat of that. So you're basically wasting our time. And I think there's some undertones there that there was maybe some political interest in trying to dig out more of these records. But of course, you know, that's perhaps the debate is, you know, should the agency spend money on trying to find these records, or should they just kind of let it lie?
And Matthew, do we know how much money it has cost to look for these records so far, and what the total projection is?
Well, when they provided those 20,000 pages back in February, they said it cost $5,000, I think more than 85 hours of staff time. And again, that's just for one of the 28. They've since provided, I believe, two others. And of course, BCI was the first. So they've provided four out of the 28. And then there's a fifth one that they may not have to look for because they found the staff review. But it's costing, you know, certainly some amount of money and time. So it's, again, I think that's part of why there's a debate, because it's a pretty onerous task to do, but I think it's maybe up to the taxpayers and the public to figure out whether they think it's worth the time and money.
We're talking with Matthew DeFore from the Wisconsin State Journal. He's talking about a dispute between the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation and two Democrats on its board over open records requests. And anyone who's been in Wisconsin this past couple of years knows that open records has been a big deal here. How does that sort of backdrop play into what we're seeing play out at the WEDC?
Well, certainly there's a lot of suspicion when we talk about records not being produced in a timely fashion. And I think that's certainly a concern here, because it has been, again, almost a year since our first investigation came out. And that certainly raised a lot of red flags about what the agency was doing in its first couple of years. But, you know, again, as time goes forward, the agency has improved a lot of its processes. I think they're certainly under a lot of pressure to show to the public that they're operating in a much more efficient and better fashion than they were initially. I think, again, when they were operating fresh out of the gate, I think that was a time when things were much more difficult. It's still, though, I think the public has a very high expectation that the public agencies that they pay for with their taxpayer money will be providing records in a timely fashion. I think that's the issue here.
Well, and this thing has gotten contentious enough that last month the Department of Justice stepped in and started to mediate in a way. What did they say?
Well, that was at the request of Representative Barca and Senator Lassa. And it came after there was a meeting in February, a public board meeting of the WEDC, where there was actual discussion, I would almost say argumentation, in this meeting about whether this was an appropriate request for records. And after that, the Democrats on the board asked the DOJ to get involved, and they did send a letter a couple weeks ago responding to the Democrats, saying that they had contacted the agency, they had talked to them about the importance of following the open records law, of communicating with the people requesting the records, and doing so in a timely fashion. And I think the result of that has been that the agency has said very clearly that they are working on this and they're trying to get them the records as quickly as possible. But again, it was just it's taken some time.
Is there any projection on when they might complete the request?
Not that I'm aware of. But again, they're working at it, and it seems like they're turning over a few awards worth of material every few weeks. So, but given as how many awards there are, and given some of them are much more voluminous than others, you know, it could take several more months.
As we were talking about open records in the state, and in March, Governor Scott Walker issued an executive order requiring state agencies to process open records requests promptly. In this case, how is that coming into play? Do we know what promptly is, and will it go any further, do you think?
Right. Well, and that's certainly been something we've seen from the governor's office to try to make sure that records are produced in a timely fashion. Again, the issue here is the volume. And when you think about 462,000 documents, that's not even pages. That's, you know, each document could be a page, it could be 3 pages, it could be 5 pages. So you can imagine how much time it takes for lawyers to review those documents, to make sure if anything needs to be marked for privacy, that they follow the law on those things. It can be an onerous process. But then, you know, if the public wants these records and thinks that they should have them, should they perhaps have more resources in order to review them? I think that's a question that's sort of raised by this story.
Matthew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Veronica, for having me.
That was Matthew DeForest, a Capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, talking about an open records request of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, our guests tell us about an effort to use the arts to improve the quality of life for people living in long-term care centers for seniors.
First, the weather finally getting warmer here in Wisconsin, which means the bugs are back, even though mosquitoes get a lot of media attention for spreading diseases like Zika. Ticks, it turns out, transmit more pathogens to humans and animals.
Gemma Tarlak is with us to share surprising facts about bug bites and other science news.
Gemma Tarlak's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month for a look at some of the coolest science headlines. Gemma, welcome back.
Hello, my fellow science lovers.
Well, we'll get to those bugs in just a few minutes, but I want to start with another story this month, vibrating insoles that are going to help our balance as we age. What's up with
that? Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, all of us, you, me, your mom, we all have neurons in our feet.
Which I don't think of. I think of neurons in my head, in my brain.
Yeah, well, you got them in your feet too, trust me. And that really, it actually helps us control balance. And as we age, they get desensitized. And that's actually one of the big reasons that a lot of senior citizens have poor balance and falls, which, as we know, can lead to really devastating injuries. So this inventor, he is working through Harvard to develop this insole. It looks like your average insole that you would, you know, stick in a shoe, whether you have, I don't know, odor eaters or whatever kind of orthotic insole you use. And it actually, through vibrations you can't feel, sensitizes or resensitizes those neurons, and it helps seniors maintain their balance.
So these are vibrations that you can't feel. So you're not going to be walking along and feeling tingling feet. It sounds
right.
Like your brain
it's
is
not going to be like magic fingers for your feet now.
But how come these aren't available yet, Gemma?
Well, actually, the interesting thing is the prototype is done. They're happy with it, but they're just not quite sure how to get licensing and bring it to market, because they can go through, say, a medical device company and get FDA approval. But because this is such a new thing, they're not sure if they need to go that route or if they should pair with, you know, like a footwear company that might give them a higher profile in terms of marketing. So they're talking to a lot of people and really deciding on the best, most effective way to bring this to market.
And Gemma, let me make sure I understand how this works. Does this only work when you're wearing these magic slippers, or are they resensitizing these neurons in your feet so they're going to work even when you're not wearing, when you're barefoot or wearing something else?
My understanding is that it works when you're wearing them,
okay.
But the great thing is the design is so low profile that you could fit them in your gym shoes, you could fit them in your dress shoes, because early on when they first started working on this, the design, it had this like huge battery pack that you had to clip to your shoe and everything. Now it just looks like any other insole.
Nice. Well, we're going to move on now and talk about gravitational waves. Obviously, huge news about gravitational waves out this year. So first of all, Gemma, catch us up on that.
Okay. What, I have 30 seconds to do it?
Go. You have 30 seconds.
20 words or less. Go.
Well, you know, 100 years after Einstein predicted it, they did finally detect these gravitational waves, which is a key, it's key to really understanding our universe in a whole new way. And we detected them through LIGO. That's the actual instrumentation. It's in Washington State and Louisiana. But the really exciting new news is that there's a thing called KAGRA, and that is in Japan, in central Japan. It is another gravitational wave detector that they're almost done building. It's going to come online soon, and they're going to have data in less than 2 years. And that's going to give us even more additional information so we can understand these waves much better and how they relate to pretty much everything in the world. The cool thing about the Japanese observation system, by the way, it's in a mountain. So it is not subject to, you know, you might think of Japan, there's a lot of seismic activity, it's on the Ring of Fire. Fortunately, this is going to be more stable, and it's going to allow them to do reading despite the fact that Japan is a pretty seismically active country.
And as I understand it, some of the instruments go down like a third of a mile under the surface. Why do they need to do that?
Well, it helps stabilize it, as I said, from seismic activity on the surface. And it just really, you know, I think part of it is, too, that they had this disused zinc mine. They needed
Andy?
Something in it. No, I'm oversimplifying things. But there are a lot of reasons why it's really good for stability and for the accuracy of the data.
So, Gemma, this news was broken just last year about the discovery of gravitational waves. Does this mean that if that first lab hadn't gotten to it, this Japanese lab would have gotten to it first a couple years down the road?
Well, actually, the discovery, I think it was in February of this year. You know, there are a lot of really smart people out there who have been hunting this thing for decades, and the data that they have, it's not, even though they announced it at the beginning of this year, it's not like they got the data this year. The data, they've had it for a while, and they've just been basically double and triple checking it. So then they announced it this year, but it's been a while that they've had it. And, you know, sure, I think Kagra is going to just add to the breadth of information that we have about gravitational waves.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, rounding up some of the top recent stories in the world of science. Let's take a quick look at gene sequencing, Gemma. There's been a lot of new technology getting easier and cheaper. What's the latest on what's called, this is a great name, the CRISPR-Cas9 technology?
Yeah, well, you know, I think a lot of times we hear news stories of people talking about CRISPR-Cas9. It's like, I don't know, it's just everywhere. But we jump into explaining exactly what CRISPR is. It really is, you want to think of a cut-and-paste editor that works on genes rather than, you know, words. And we get into it pretty deeply in terms of what it is and how it's being used by several different organizations in the Bay Area, in San Francisco area. Huge amount of innovation going on there, and it's so ubiquitous out there that even high school students are using it in their experiments.
And Gemma, just quickly before we move on to bug bites, so what is some of the cool stuff that people are starting to do with this? There's a boom going on right now.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the coolest things, and also I think maybe one of the scariest things, there is a guy in the San Francisco area, Josiah Zahner, who is selling do-it-yourself CRISPR kits for like $60 or so.
Wow.
You know, yeah, you can go online, search DIY CRISPR kits, learn modern science by doing. That's his pitch. And, yeah, for $60, you can get this kit, and you can do simple experiments with it. It's not like you're going to be able to, you know, suddenly increase your athletic ability or something like that, but you can turn yeast different colors and do that kind of thing and really understand how the technology works by actually doing it.
So we can't recreate Jurassic Park in our basements yet.
Speak for yourself.
I think Gemma's saying we're almost there.
Almost.
That's
there.
What I
Sounds
heard her
good.
Saying.
Well, Gemma, we teased the bug bites. People want to hear about the bugs. It's that time of year. Now, first of all, you wrote about 20 things we didn't know. First of all, when we're saying bugs here, we're not technically talking mostly about bugs, are we?
That's right. That's right. Bed bugs are bugs. They're true bugs. They belong to the order Hemiptera. But, you know, when we say mosquitoes and ticks and flies and fleas, those are not actually bugs. They're insects, but they're not bugs. So anyway, let's not go that bug lane for them all. But yeah, you know, colloquially we say bug bites. And just, you know, Mother's Day was yesterday, and so it was on my mind, the truth about mosquitoes. Mosquitoes who bite us, they are real mothers, okay? And in the sense that they, only females who are about to reproduce bite in terms of mosquitoes. So So it's only females who are looking to reproduce and make baby mosquitoes. They're the only ones who actually bite, and it's because they need the protein and iron and blood to produce their eggs. And I think this is really interesting. There's this jumping spider in eastern Africa that has evolved to feed preferentially on female mosquitoes. So I think that's like karma. You know?
Well, what do you make of it that the mosquitoes seem to only bite pregnant women, or at least they prefer pregnant women? I shouldn't say they only, but they seem to have a preference, right?
Yeah, they're actually about twice as likely to bite pregnant women. And that's another kind of unjustified karma bit, right? But they think it has to do with a lot of different factors, including pregnant women happen to have an increased body temperature. So they're a little bit warmer. They may be easier to find. It may be chemicals that they're secreting during gestation that also attract the mosquitoes. So, yeah, it seems awful, doesn't it? You know?
It's not fair.
Well, and while we're talking about quote-unquote bugs, mosquitoes, of course, carry a lot of diseases. But you write, and we kind of know this here in Wisconsin, ticks carry a big variety of diseases.
Yeah, they do. And they're also unusual in that they don't have like a one-and-done relationship with their host. You know, they hang on, literally, sometimes for weeks, and they feed multiple times. And, you know, there was just recently looking at their saliva, tick saliva. I'm sorry for anyone eating right now, but tick saliva is really fascinating because they have evolved all these special enzymes that can actually do things like dull the pain so you don't really feel like you're, you know, being bitten. Maybe you don't notice. So tick saliva is pretty fascinating.
Gemma, that was just a taste, an unpleasant taste of all the bug facts you reveal. Thank you, as always. It's been a lot of fun.
Same here. Thank you.
It's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to look at some of the coolest science headlines.
Coming up after the news, we'll hear about a theater project in Milwaukee that aims to improve the quality of life for people living in senior care centers. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll get an advanced look at a new Wisconsin public television documentary about the cost of gun violence in Milwaukee.
First, when we think of elder care and senior living centers, a major theatrical production might not be the first thing that comes to mind. But a project in Milwaukee bridged that gap as part of an effort to use the arts to improve the quality of life for people living in senior care facilities. Here's a listen to the play Finding Penelope.
If the gods will grant us a happier old age, we'll be free from our trials at last.
Over the course of 2 years, our next guest organized a production at the Luther Manor Long-Term Care Center in Milwaukee. They brought together theater experts with the staff and residents there. The play, Finding Penelope, follows the character Penelope from Homer's Odyssey.
Anne Basting and Ellie Rose join us now. Anne is a professor of theater at UW-Milwaukee and founder of Time Slips Creative Storytelling. Ellie's the director of the Milwaukee-based nonprofit Gerostart Incorporated. They're co-editors of the new book, The Penelope Project, an arts-based odyssey to change elder care. Anne, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
And Ellie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Ellie, what was the goal from the outset of The Penelope Project?
I think each contributing party had a different goal. And so the first goal would be all coming together to have a unified objective. And it was really about engaging people that were living at Luther Manor, both living, visiting, and volunteering at Luther Manor in an arts-based project.
And talk about the idea of using the arts in a senior setting. And this is something you've done a lot, in some cases for people with dementia, and in this case, just a more general setting.
I really find that the arts are sort of a shortcut toward building community because the arts are an emotional language, and so it allows you to bridge differences of generation and culture and ability and disability and age as a way to find a way to connect and to really grow with each other toward a common goal. And like Ellie said, we were really aspiring to create world-class art at Luther Manor in a collaboration between university students, a professional theater company, and the entire long-term care community. None of us could accomplish that alone. We really needed each other to do it, and the arts were the soft tissue that enabled us to reach that goal.
Ellie, tell us more about that collaboration. Who was at the table, and how did they come together?
Well, actually, I think Anne would be a better person to talk about it, but some of those initial meetings proved to be some of the cornerstones for why this project was successful.
And it really was about listening to what each other needed. So, Anne, can you talk a little more about that?
Sure. The theater company was Sojourn Theater, and they were really known. They're a national theater company, and they were really known for doing art making in non-traditional places. But they'd never made world-class art like this before in a place where people were living. So we had to really negotiate the relationships every day and learn how to be in company with people with profound disabilities and invite them into the art-making experience, as well as independent living folks, staff, family members, the whole thing. And then from the student side, we really wanted it to be an incredible learning experience. The challenge is for a two-year project, you realize you can't engage students over 2 years. So we had students cycling in and out in different aspects of the project, from performance and research and sort of data, creative data gathering. The whole thing was a very dynamic and exciting collaboration.
Talking to Anne Basing and Ellie Rose, they're co-editors of the new book, The Penelope Project, and this tells the story of the creation, a two-year process to put on a show at a senior facility in Milwaukee. Now, let's go to the show now. First of all, Anne, why Penelope? Why this story from the Odyssey?
You know, I love working in epic forms because it's and a story older and bigger than anyone in the room. So it allows you to come together with these epic themes that really have questions inside of them that pull on the bare threads of humanity and what it means to be human. And we got a Wisconsin Humanities Council grant to study it and to bring in a classic scholar, Andrew Porter from UWM, who helped us unpack some of those themes of Greek codes of hospitality and what does it mean to find home and all of these journeys inside of the themes of the Odyssey. But instead of looking at Odysseus, who everybody looks at, right, we looked at the hero who never left home, who created a sense of home and then welcomed the stranger back into the home, which was the strength of Penelope, which everyone overlooks. And we were kind of making that parallel to everyone overlooks residents of long-term care communities. And we sort of found the common thread between the story of Penelope and the residents of Luther Manor.
Ellie, I'm going to ask Anne a little more about what went into the making of the show. But when it all came together and you saw it, what was it like?
When I saw the show, I mean, I was very much behind the scenes, but watching it in general, I could have never anticipated how powerful it would be. And when I say powerful, it was really watching the people that came to Luther Manor to watch the production, because the production was not necessarily on a stage as you normally think about a theatrical production. It was in the hallways and in the lobby spaces and near nurses stations within our residential living. So to watch people visit our location and to travel through those spaces and to enjoy it, to interact with people in a different kind of way, and then to see this end scene that really moved people to tears and to see how impacted they are by just talking about what it's like to age and what it might be like to wait within a nursing home, to wait to depend on people, and it was just really moving. So I think the entire scene that was at the end was the most powerful, but in general, just watching everyone that was involved.
We've got a clip from a documentary about the Penelope Project linked at the Central Time Facebook page, and something I saw there was how the residents engaged in the play. They were kind of a chorus. Can you talk about the role a lot of them played?
We wanted to make sure that there was an opportunity for everyone who wanted to be involved to be in it. And so we had this idea of the chorus, and the idea really evolved over time because of what we discovered through the relationships. And really, Ellie was a crucial part of learning how to discover that. People were scared to participate. Do I have to memorize? Am I going to be feeling well enough on that day? How would I rehearse? Who are the people I would do this with? I'm not good enough. All of these things were keeping people with, you know, creating anxiety around performing, which is what, you know, you'd expect if you're not a performer to suddenly be in a professionally produced play in the place that you're living. So we really retreated from that and just said, anyone who wants to, just show up. It's all call and response. We wanted to create an opportunity for families to come together, for staff and residents to participate together in that role. And so they were all playing Penelope. And it was a huge moment of trust for the artists, because no one ever knew, actually, on any given day of the performance, who would be on that stage, because it really changed every single day. I was happy to see that it grew from one performance to the next, but it was a real trust factor and very powerful in that way. And the other thing we wanted to do was create a sense of a blur between everyday life and a heightened sense of performance, which when you create that blur, even people who live and work there, you don't see the place the same. Is this real life or is this performance? And an audience member coming in won't just see it as a nursing home, but a place of possibility and meaning. And that's what adding the layer of chorus and performance into that place really did, transformed it into a place of potential and meaning.
Ellie, can you talk about that some more? Because in the book, you write some of the aftermath pieces. How did this space, Luther Manor, change after this performance?
Well, I think one of the biggest changes was just thinking about what engagement means and what it means to have an activity program. Because within a long-term care institution, we have many different departments and we have different activity programs, and there's very generic things that we engage in. You know, we have typical arts programs like arts and crafts or some sort of brain exercise, things that you would expect, but this was something that was really radical. And to engage in something that radical will change you forever. So now we have different activity people that are planning programs. They're starting to think bigger. They're starting to imagine what they want it to be instead of what it has to be. So the aftermath, you know, years after, there's those of us that have been touched by this, and no matter, you know, who or what program we're in, we are impacted by being able to imagine.
We're talking about arts and elder care and a theater project at a senior care center in Milwaukee. Our guests were involved in that project. They're co-editors of a new book just out. It's called The Penelope Project, an arts-based odyssey to change elder care.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If you have an experience with elder care as a senior yourself, as a family member or a staff member, do you see a role for the arts in that care? And what kinds of things have you seen where you work or you live? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation about arts and elder care. Our guests are Ann Basting and Ellie Rose, and they're co-editors of the new book, The Penelope Project, an arts-based odyssey to change elder care. They were involved in a major theater project at an elder care center in Milwaukee.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How can arts improve the quality of life at senior care facilities? Do you have an experience with this, maybe as a senior yourself, a family member, or working in elder care? And hey, did you participate in this Penelope Project? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. Terry is on the line in Oconomowoc. Terry, hi.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to share with you that I had also worked in a nursing facility as an activity director and used to do radio shows with the residents there. And it was a smaller venue, but you could include people and families and, you know, make it a social on a Sunday afternoon. And I also wanted to share that our high school does murder, or is going to be doing like a murder mystery in a nursing facility coming shortly.
Terry, thanks a lot for sharing what you've done over there. Ellie, let's talk about the radio idea, like the theater project, involves the residents in the creation of the project. How important is that?
Oh, it's probably one of the most important things. So you're doing a great job, Terry, and so happy to hear that. Actually, one of the projects that came after the Penelope Project was a radio show, and it was led by residents of our independent living, and they really wanted to think about what it's like to do a production where you don't have to rely on performing in front of people on a stage, because that would require memorizing lines. And so on radio, people can't necessarily see you, and then you're reading off of a sheet of paper, so you're not required to memorize something. And that program really took off, and more people got involved. And so radio is a great way to think about an alternative way of doing a theatrical production. So, again, great job, Terry. Looking forward to seeing what comes out of that.
And Ellie, Terry talked about high school students getting involved with the program. Is that something that you've seen done or think could be a follow-up to the Penelope Project?
Yeah, most definitely. I think, you know, Anne did such a great job of engaging the students of a university, and I don't see why that couldn't be done, you know, with individuals in high school. Oftentimes they have requirements, you know, for whether it's volunteering or just action learning and learning in different environments. I don't think teachers always think about, you know, long-term care as a place to do active learning. But, you know, when you're thinking about the arts and doing different collaborative programs, you know, why not do it there? And why not think about the individuals that are living there who so much still want to be a part of younger people's lives and society in general? So I look forward to seeing what comes out of it.
Terry, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And you wrote a passage in the book about fear and trepidation, the fear that people have of working with older adults in particular. Maybe that reflects, I don't know, a fear of aging itself. How did you try to overcome those fears in the Penelope Project?
You know, that's one of the keys to why you use the arts, because it can be strength-based. And I think that we, in general, in our culture, have a trepidation and a fear around loss. We don't know how to talk about it, or we fear when other people are experiencing it. You don't know what to say to people. And if you both come to something where you can answer anything, where people can use movement, if that's a strength that they have, or, you know, paint or color or words, where you move to a place where people have strength and can participate and can show their humor and their kind of snarky attitude sometimes, you know, you can share in that and find connection between people, particularly across the generations. And younger people lose their fear and realize, oh my gosh, there's people here and we can bond. And it also is good, I think, you know, it's important that all those assignments in high schools and even down to elementary schools where go interview your grandparents or your older neighbor and find out what their life was like when they were young. That's great. But that's like everyone's asking who the person was instead of who they are right now. And like with the Reader's Theater, which I think is a fantastic, great job, Terry, and keep going. Finding a point that where people can connect in the now and fight for something or explore something together that's relevant right now will bring meaning to it. And that's what people are lacking. You know, there's some really great research on well-being now that purpose and meaningfulness are what give us satisfaction in our lives and which contribute to our health.
I want to jump in, Anne. You've told us on the Ideas Network in the past about communicating, especially with people with dementia, that there's that unproductive thing, like, don't you remember, or do you remember, do you remember? And maybe they don't, whereas if you are working on creating something new, whether it's storytelling or other forms of art, that ends up being a much better communication for all parties involved.
Yep, and if you think about it, asking, I like to call it asking beautiful questions, questions that open people into the now instead of focus on maybe a yes or no answer or something that has a fact behind it. Right now, one of the outcomes of the Penelope Project is that at the university, we have student artists in residence who we've assigned 8 of them to aging services providers across the county. And they're learning how to do this kind of program. So we went from Luther Manor to like spreading it out to care communities across the city and training student artists to be like Ellie, an artist in residence who was at Luther Manor doing this incredible work, to really open up people with those beautiful questions.
Talking to Anne Basting and Ellie Rose about the Penelope Project. This is a theater project at a Milwaukee elder care facility. New book called The Penelope Project, An Arts-Based Odyssey to Change Elder Care. Ellie, let's talk a little bit more about lessons learned. If people out there are family members of somebody living in a facility, living there themselves, organizing activities, what is a message you would give to them based on your experience?
I think I would share with them that the arts are, for one, powerful. And when I say powerful, I choose that word because when you're working with someone in advanced, you know, ages, or with someone living with dementia or any sort of cognitive impairment at all, building a relationship is something that you have to relearn or to do again. So to build a relationship through the arts is a totally different kind of relationship. And I like to use the word that it's balanced. I don't always know what's going to come out of a conversation with someone, or what we're going to produce when we're making art, or what kind of story we're going to create together. There's no, you know, outcome that is, and, you know, something that I'm going to predict is going to have it happen. There's no expectation. And so if I join a conversation or a project that way with no expectation, then we're both learning, both engaging with the same energy. And so the arts have the power to do that. So when you're faced with caring for someone living with dementia, or just caring for somebody at home who has physical disabilities of any sort, why not think about using the arts as a way to create something together? Not that I'm going to create something for you or over you, not that I'm smarter or better than you, but that we're creating something together.
Anne, you've done a lot of work with older adults, and you write in the book that when people ask you what you do, especially in the theater community, you say, oh, I work with older adults in the theater. They say, really? Is there a need for that? And people have this awkward pause. But you've been at this a while. Do you think this is starting to catch on, this idea that we need more creative expression for older adults?
It's really exciting to have watched this field just blossom. And it's blossoming in a way that opens up, it's not just the field of aging, it's connecting the whole community. So it used to be that we set up kind of separate systems and worlds. Once you got older, you went to senior centers, or if you had memory loss, you went to a specific dementia care place. Now we're opening up the world so that the community itself can embrace people. So museums like the Spark Alliance program in Wisconsin offer programs for people with memory loss, or memory cafes that are popping up all over. We have in Milwaukee what's called the Creative Trust MKE. CreativeTrustMKE.com is an alliance of all these care communities and aging services programs that are committed to lifelong learning through the arts. And learning was not something you ever heard associated with, like, say, people with dementia or people on hospice. Like, I want all of my days, even up to the very end, to be filled with possibility and meaning and potential.
And we'll talk to you more about that in the future. We've been talking to Anne Basting and Ellie Rose. Thanks to both of them. They're co-editors of The Penelope Project, an arts-based odyssey to elder care. You can still share your stories on the Central Time Facebook page. And again, watch a short clip of what The Penelope Project was all about. It's got a link on the Central Time Facebook page. The Wisconsin-grown web series Chad Vader can add another feather to its cap. The national organization Engaging Local Government Leaders recently announced that the Chad Vader video won an award for Best Public Service Announcement.
The PSA featuring YouTube star Chad Vader explains Wisconsin's new voter ID law. The film was made in Madison and stars Aaron Yanda and Matt Sloan. Dane County Clerk Scott McDonald wrote the script.
To set up Chad Vader is Darth Vader's less accomplished brother who manages the night shift at a grocery store.
Here's Chad Vader explaining what's up with Wisconsin's new voter ID law.
I am here to vote, Commander.
Great. Can I see an ID?
ID? You do not need to see my ID.
Yeah, I do. It's the law.
But you know who I am. Don't make me destroy you.
Yeah, I know who you are. You're Chad Vader from the grocery store. But according to this new law, I need proper identification, such as a valid driver's license, a Wisconsin ID card, a passport, a military ID. That would work, too.
Such insolence will not be tolerated. I made a rather large contribution to the Senate Imperial Re-election Committee. This puny law is not intended for a Lord of the Sith, but for rebel scum like yourself.
Congrats to the Chad Vader PSA. You can find a link to watch the whole thing on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.